All right, thanks everyone. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors here, Randy Chambers, John Kamenowski, Tiffany Troxler, Alan Wright, and Todd Osborne through various different organizations. And also I'd like to acknowledge the Florida Coastal Everglades LTER Long-Term Ecological Research, staff for the field support, University of Florida for being able to get me here, as well as some of the NSF funding through the LTER program that kind of made this all possible. So real quick introduction-wise, we have pyrite here with a goldish-looking stuff, hence its name, Fool's Gold, and then its kind of sister compound, hematite. Pyrite's formed by various factors. It's controlled by various factors. We have iron oxides. We have sulfides. They interact, combine, and get pyrite. It's controlled, obviously, by redox, the availability of iron, the occurrence of sulfide, and organic matter. In our system here, you know, we have a lot of sulfate-reducing bacteria, which reduces available sulfate to sulfide, hence the availability, and all that is done through the consumption of organic matter. This is pyrite's obviously really sensitive to redox and oxygen, so if you know, you have a pyrite-ridden soil, if you want to call it that, you put it out, it's gonna oxidize and transform. As most of you know, sea level's on the rise. We have in South Florida here, particularly, we have anywhere from 0.6 to about 1.5 by 2100 is the kind of the projections. I think that it might have been updated recently, but I'm not 100% sure. But regardless, we're expected to see some kind of rise. One really key fact here is the Everglades National Park, which is our study area. Approximately 60% of it, give or take, is below 0.9 elevation. So that sea level rise, we'll see it in Everglades National Park. And we already see it today. So the image to you on the right here, the black and white, I think is 1960s, 1970s. You see this, let's see if I can do this. This area here is considered the white zone. This is where we, where sea level or just vegetation changes. So you have that ecotone between freshwater to marine systems, and you have this white zone. This white zone is indicative of, tidal influences. That white zone has expanded, and you can kind of see it in this color one, where it's mostly just the white zone. And this is on the southeastern side of Everglades National Park. And you can see here this image to the left. There's a person standing up here on the, what I guess you can call maybe the high marsh now, but there's a drastic drop. Probably about a 2-foot drop. That's actually collapsing of freshwater peat into the estuary. So our objective was essentially to characterize this iron-sulfur interaction and also kind of assess the degree of pyritization across the Everglades system, the coastal Everglades system, with the hypothesis that the degree of pyritization, so how much pyrite is formed, is dependent upon the organic matter as well as obviously the sulfur. And also to kind of take the next step and say to evaluate this degree of pyritization as kind of a biogeochemical indicator of sea level rise. And with the expectation that we'll see changes in this degree of pyritization in estuarine and freshwater systems as we see sea levels rise. As I said, our study area is Everglades National Park. We have a freshwater to marine gradient, so you go from a sawgrass marsh to essentially seagrass. We have two main drainages here, so we have Shark River Slough in the middle, which is the largest of the two, and then we have Taylor Slough, which is the smallest, I guess you can call it, not often forgotten. And then right next to that, there's an even smaller area considered the Panhandle. Over here, and then we have Florida Bay proper. Each site is characterized through both biogeochemical factors as well as kind of its land position. So we have the freshwater sites up here. We have estuarine or ecotone sites and estuary. And then Florida Bay is, of course, the marine sites. So our data, we have soil samples collected between 2004 and 2015. Actually, there's still some data being collected now. We take syringe cores at 10 centimeters and just plug and go. And those samples are analyzed for bulk density, soil organic matter, acid volatile sulfide, chromium reducible sulfur, and acid extracted iron. And as well, in a separate effort, there's monthly salinity monitoring at all these stations with some poor water data as well, but that's not being presented here today. So we can take this, the ABS, the acid volatile sulfide, the chromium reducible sulfate or sulfur, and your extractable iron, get this kind of metric of degree of pyritization by using essentially math. And then you can characterize that based on the DOP values to be anaerobic, anoxic, and anaerobic. That's just basically the redox condition of based on the availability of CRS and extractable iron. Real quick, our site characteristics. Like I said, we have Shirker Rasuli here on this. It's a little bit easier to see on this aerial image. You can see down the middle there, that's Shark River Slough, and then we have Taylor Slough. These soils are generally very different. Here you can see a bulk density organic matter curve. If you look at the dark dots, which are mostly all the way over here on the high organic matter side, and even kind of on the higher end of this curve, that's mostly organic soils, peaty soils. And then the Taylor Slough ones, might not be able to see too many of them, but they're the squares. They're mostly down here in this area, and some are over here. But there's, for the most part, it's a marly mineral type soil. So that right there is one huge difference between these two areas. So CRS concentrations are an order of magnitude greater than your ABS. So pyrite diagenesis is occurring. I mean, we're forming pyrite one way or another. And it's dependent upon, obviously, some several factors, as I said, but there's also spatial differences. So you have Shark River Slough, Taylor Slough, the Panhandle area, and then that Florida Bay area. Each system is a little bit different in and of itself. Shark River Slough has a lot of organic matter and a lot of sulfur. Taylor Slough, not so much. Florida Bay is pretty anemic. And here's kind of an average, like time series of pyrite in these different systems. So you can see on the top it goes freshwater to marine, and then we have Shark River Slough to Florida Bay. You can see that there's a lot of variability from any given year, especially in the early years. That's when we were really dry, to say in the freshwater later, more recent years, it was more wet. If you do a trend analysis, the ecotone in Shark River Slough area is the only one that really sees this dramatic increase and kind of just stays constant, which is good, could be bad. If you take that site characterization and you kind of look at it at both a flow path, kind of the Shark River Slough, Taylor Slough, Florida Bay, Panhandle area, as well as the kind of the ecosystem type, so you have your freshwater, ecotone, estuary, and marine, you can see that there's obviously differences between these, both the areas and the flow paths. And like I said, it's driven by biogeochemical differences. We have differences in peat versus marl soils. We have differences in redox condition, where the freshwater area, especially in Shark River Slough, has the potential to dry out a lot more. You have in the ecotone and estuary area, you have this ability of the marine water to wash up in those areas and deposit sulfur and stimulate that sulfide-reducing bacteria. And, of course, there's differences in iron availability, where most people would call Florida Bay anemic. There's some surface water inputs into these systems of iron, not a whole bunch. Most of it is detrital, and it settles out very quickly. Jumping over to salinity, here's just the ecotone and estuary sites as surface water only. We have both. We have the stations kind of labeled out for you, so you can kind of see the variability between ecotone and estuary areas. This pointer is giving me hassle. There we go. So we have ecotone here, estuary here. Sorry for the data gap. Funding sucks sometimes. This red dot for this area here is Shark River Slough 4, which is this area here. Shark River Slough 5 is that high estuary site. And we just so happen to see a significant trend for this period of record at that particular site, which to me that would indicate sea level rise to some extent because it's seeing more salt on a given day. Looking at the pyrite salinity interaction, I guess you can call it, if you regress the two, again, ecotone and estuary. The only site that we really saw any significant relationship is this estuary site in Shark River Slough, which is Shark River Slough 5, which was the one that had the significant increase in salinity. So to kind of bring everything around, pyrite formation is dependent obviously upon several different factors. It's not just a magical thing that happens. Sea level rise has the ability to impact or not impact, but maybe stimulate more pyrite formation in sites that may not usually get it because of additions of sulfur and also inundation. Upstream water management also helps. So in the freshwater system, all these things are there. And if we keep managing the water to keep it wet, since it is a wetland, you would expect pyrite formation to occur. We have obviously seen DOP and salinity increases in Shark River Slough, which is that big drainage. And there have been signs of peak collapse and sea level rise observed. In the estuary or in the ecotone area, we haven't really seen the statistical relationship, but it seems like there's some relatedness to it. And, you know, the curves are starting to kind of bend that way. And for the DOP and salinity relationship in the Taylor Slough area specifically, that area is drier, so it doesn't have that much more water. The tidal influence isn't as much. So it's kind of, again, a unique system. And also there's the biogeochemical component of it. It's a more marly, less organic matter kind of area. So obviously there's more work to be done, but maybe this metric could be used to kind of give us indications of sea level rise on the surface sediment and soils. With that, I can take any questions. And one shameless plug. Ta-da! Told you to say it again. Go ahead.
So I'm a little curious about your terminology relating aerobic, anaerobic, or anoxic to. So you're describing some of this 50% of the iron has been converted to pyrite.
Oops.
Aerobic?
Yeah. If it's less than 50%.
You have up to 46% of the iron tied up in pyrite.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is based off of paleo limnologic metrics. We haven't done the work to kind of ground truth it per se in this freshwater real life system. So.
Let me just ask a different question. So, in terms of your salinity influences, do you have a sense of sort of what salinity level sulfate becomes limiting? I mean, part of your sort of model is that as you increase sulfate, you're going to increase the degree of pyritization. But,
right.
You know, and you got all these confounding factors, carbon, iron, this sort of thing. But do you have a sense of how much, what's the salinity level above which, you know, sulfate would no longer be limiting?
Yeah, what's the break point where sulfate becomes limiting or doesn't? With salinity. That's a good question, and that's definitely another component of this, to be able to use it as a metric of sea level rise. You know, I would expect anything above, you know, off the cuff 5, right? Because anything above that, you're super saline. Or not super saline, you're more saline than you usually are, especially in freshwater systems. So that's kind of, obviously more work needs to be done with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.